Sometimes a store is more than a store, especially if the store in question has plenty of comfortable furniture and a nice cafeteria. Twice a week, an informal Lonely Hearts Club gathers inside an IKEA store, an outlet of the worldwide furniture chain in Shanghai. People gather at IKEA hoping for free coffee and conversation and maybe a date. IKEA says the group is messing up their business and wants them out. But when you meet some of the people, you learn a lot about IKEA and about its relationship with the changing China. Here's NPR's Frank Langfitt.
The pensioners begin arriving around 1 in the afternoon and fill nearly 20 tables in the store cafeteria. They sit for hours, drinking coffee, gossiping, and subtly checking each other out. Ge, a smartly dressed 50-year-old, retired this year.
You can find a boyfriend or girlfriend or just make friends and chat. It makes you a little bit happier.
Ge's friend, surnamed Han, is a retired bus ticket seller. She says IKEA is a good place to meet people if you're divorced or widowed.
There's matchmaking, a lot of matchmaking.
Ge explains.
If I meet a guy and he's appropriate for me, we can call each other. But if he finds someone more suitable for me, he'll help and introduce me to the other guy.
The women refuse to give their full names. They don't want their families to know they visit IKEA. Han says it's just too embarrassing.
When we go out, we don't tell people we're going here. We tell them that we're going to a tea house. We don't tell them that we go to IKEA, because IKEA is the place to find boyfriends and girlfriends.
Retirees began coming to the IKEA in Shanghai's Shuwei district about 3 years ago. The phenomenon is a result of the nation's rising divorce rate, changing demographics, and the comfort of the stores themselves. Xiao, he won't give his name either, is 70. He used to work as a manager at a local Unilever factory.
Shanghai has become an aging society with many single senior citizens. They need to make friends. They feel lonely at home. So what IKEA does is laudable, and we wish IKEA's business will prosper. I am thankful for IKEA's tolerance towards us.
Actually, IKEA's tolerance has pretty much run out. The company's tired of the Lonely Hearts drinking gallons of coffee, but never buying anything. Recently, when some Lonely Hearts became unruly, IKEA cordoned off a section of the cafeteria to pen them in. IKEA managers refuse to discuss the problem. They don't want the publicity, but they have posted a sign. It reads, "Your behavior is affecting the normal operations of the IKEA cafeteria. Frequent fights and arguments do serious harm to the image both of Shanghai residents and IKEA." Torsten Stocker studies consumer products in China for Monitor Group, a U.S.-based management consulting company. He says Chinese feel comfortable being themselves in IKEA because the shopping experience is so different from most here.
It feels more like a place of leisure rather than a place where you would go to buy furniture. It represents also the nice home that to some extent they aspire to and that they would like to have.
In fact, some Chinese have always treated IKEA like an extension of their own homes. When the first store opened in Beijing in 1998, people napped on the beds. Families camped out on sofa sets, reading newspapers, drinking tea from glass jars, and eating biscuits. Ms. Ge, one of the Lonely Hearts, admits they don't treat the company very well.
I don't think it's appropriate because this is a money-making business. The best thing would be if we had places like this in our own community. Even if there's no coffee or tea, we can bring our own.
For now, IKEA and the Lonely Hearts are in an uneasy truce. The long-suffering Swedes are unwilling to force the Chinese seniors out, and the Lonely Hearts don't want to give up IKEA's modern comforts and all that free coffee. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
From monetary policy now to food policy. These days, our food comes through complicated global supply chains. It's a system driven by efficiency. But our next story is about a truly spectacular breakdown in that system. It happened in Asia and didn't affect Americans very much. As Dan Charles with NPR's Planet Money team reports, the failure keeps experts awake at night because they don't know how to keep it from happening again.
This disaster, and it really was a disaster for a lot of people, involves rice. It was the worst crisis involving food prices in half a century. But this one did not start with droughts or a bad harvest. There was plenty of rice in the world. This crisis started with a simple cost-saving decision in India. The Indian government decided to buy more rice for its food distribution programs instead of wheat, because wheat was really expensive. And to make sure there was plenty of cheap rice on hand, They made it illegal for most Indian rice to leave the country. In October 2007, they banned rice exports.
This was the trigger, and we saw it, the next day. The next day, prices in Bangkok go up $75 a ton.
Peter Timmer is an economist and one of the world's leading experts on the rice trade. The Indian decision set off a chain of reactions. Each one was perfectly understandable, but altogether they were destructive. The Indian ban on exports meant there was less for other countries to buy. That's why prices shot up. And then people said, if rice is getting more expensive, we need to get our hands on some right now. Even smart economists like Peter Timmer were part of this. He was teaching at Stanford at the time.
I'd gone to Trader Joe's and picked up 6 boxes of rice because I knew it was going to be really expensive in about 2 weeks.
You were a rice hoarder.
I was a rice hoarder. I felt so embarrassed. But it's a perfectly rational thing for individuals to do.
That goes for governments, too. And in the rice business, governments really matter. Rice is so important in Asia, most governments at least try to control prices and how much gets exported. During the first 4 months of 2008, Egypt, Pakistan, and Vietnam all started hoarding their rice crop. So there was still plenty of rice in the world, but there was less for sale. And that put the squeeze on countries like the Philippines. Those countries don't grow enough on their own. They need to go out and buy rice from abroad. Panicky government officials in the Philippines went on TV to tell people to eat less rice. So, of course, people went out and bought more. Prices surged. Now, in a situation like this, if you're in a position of power and you're just looking out for yourself, this is a beautiful time. There's money to be made. This is what happened. The government of the Philippines went on a buying spree with taxpayer money. It bought a lot of rice, all from a state-run company in Vietnam called Vinafood, at super high prices. These were corrupt deals, Peter Timmer says. This is how you line your pockets, buying high-priced rice.
You sign a contract with Vinafood in Saigon. Let's say it's $1,000. Vinafood is able to go back to Vietnamese farmers and pays them $500. So now there's $500 of profit per ton, which you quietly split.
Those deals drove up the price by hundreds of dollars a ton. Rice fever spread from the Philippines across the whole continent.
What happened was people panicked everywhere. In Ho Chi Minh City, for heaven's sakes, the center of the second largest rice exporting surplus in the world, supermarkets and rice markets got cleaned out in 2 days.
During the first 4 months of 2008, the price of a ton of rice on the world market doubled. Then it tripled. In countries that relied on imported rice, people got squeezed hard. Ben Flores, a janitor in the Philippines, says he just had to eat less.
Before that, I used to eat rice every morning, so I really lost weight because of that.
This was just a crazy situation. People were going hungry. Lives were changed. Corrupt officials were getting rich, even though there still was plenty of rice in the world. Two Americans hatched a plot to pop the bubble. Peter Timmer, the economist, and Tom Slayton, who follows rice markets for a living from his home in Alexandria, Virginia.
Peter and I decided we would, quote-unquote, save the rice market.
Tom called me up and said, hey, Peter, there's 1.5 million tons of very high-quality rice sitting in Japan, the WTO rice.
WTO as in World Trade Organization. To settle a trade dispute with the U.S., Japan has agreed to take in a lot of American rice that it doesn't really want. That rice just sits in warehouses. Japan is not allowed to export it unless the U.S. says it can. Timmer and Slayton started a lobbying campaign. They said to the U.S., let the Japanese sell this rice, just this once. In mid-May 2008, the U.S. agreed. And that announcement was enough. The price started to drop. By the end of the year, the price had fallen by half. In the end, none of the rice in Japan ever was shipped. The cause of the crisis was psychological, and the solution was too. But real people were hurt. And the fear that produced the crisis is still there. It's fear that the global system for delivering food to people who need it could go crazy again. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. The Federal Reserve says the U.S. economy has strengthened a bit in recent months, but don't expect a hiring boom anytime soon. Also, the unemployment rate is expected to remain high for years. Fed policymakers wrapped up a two-day meeting this afternoon without taking any extraordinary new actions to stimulate the economy. Afterward, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke spoke to reporters, and NPR's Jim Zaroli is here to tell us what he said. Jim, the statement released by the Fed today is more optimistic than the last one in September. What is Bernanke seeing that makes him think things are picking up?
Yeah, he said, you know, household spending is up a bit, so is business investment. He has said before a lot of the problems in the economy this spring were temporary things like the Japanese earthquake and the aftermath of that. Now they've receded, so things are picking up. But he was long-term just more pessimistic than he has been. He says the labor market is a problem. It's not going to, you know, get better very soon.
Jim, Bernanke himself, of course, has been the target of criticism this year over the course of the economy. Did he address that at all?
Yeah, he was actually put on the defensive a lot. He was asked, you know, why things haven't improved more in the economy. He was asked about the growing levels of income inequality in the country, why that was happening. He said something which he has said before, that basically the Fed can't do it all, that the other parts of the government, which I presumably means Congress and the White House, need to take more active steps to create jobs. Here's what he had to say.
Certainly, we are doing our part to try to create more jobs and more opportunities in America. With respect to inequality, I think the best way to address inequality is to create jobs.
Jim, we're of course seeing demonstrations against the financial system all across the country in a lot of cities. I understand that the Fed chairman actually weighed in on Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, he says he understands the sentiment behind the protests. The economy is very bad. He was asked about the fact that the protesters, a lot of them express anger toward the Fed itself. There's a lot of unhappiness about the role that the Fed played in the 2008 bank bailout, which is still very unpopular. And Bernanke said there are a lot of misperceptions about the bailout. He said a lot of people think it was about propping up salaries for bankers.
That is obviously not the case. What we were doing was trying to protect the financial system in order to prevent a serious collapse of both the financial system and the American economy. We needed to take those steps. If we hadn't taken them, the consequences would have been dire.
But, you know, it's just hard to prove that things would have been worse if the Fed hadn't acted. So I think he's just resigned to the fact that the bank bailout is going to be misunderstood, and it won't be, I guess, up to history to decide whether the right steps were taken.
Finally, Jim, what about the bankruptcy earlier this week of the investment firm MF Global? This was one of the Fed's so-called primary dealers. Did that come up at all?
Yeah, he was asked about that. He said he pointed out that the meltdown of MF Global had happened very fast, which is a sign that the firm was over-leveraged. In other words, it had borrowed too much against its assets to do risky things. So there were clearly some problems with the way it was being run. But he did say several times that, you know, the firm was regulated by other agencies, not the Fed. So he sort of deflected blame a bit.
That's NPR's Jim Zaroli in New York. Jim, thanks.
You're welcome.
It's been a tough year for public employee unions across the country. That's true even in traditionally labor-friendly states like New York. While the state's workforce has shrunk through attrition, there have been no mass layoffs yet. As NPR's Joel Rose reports, that may soon change.
Imagine you had to choose between taking a pay cut or watching dozens of your colleagues lose their jobs. That's basically the choice facing thousands of public sector workers in New York State.
It's a lousy contract. However, people are going to save their jobs for now.
Richard Dillard is a Medicaid investigator who's worked for the state for more than 30 years, but he may not for much longer. Dillard is one of nearly 3,500 members of the Public Employees Federation who stand to lose their jobs unless the union votes to accept an austere new contract.
You can make concessions and hopefully fight to get them back. But once people lose their jobs, it's very hard, it's very difficult to get that back. There are people out there who have far worse situations than mine. Their lives would be devastated if they lost their job. So therefore, this is what I'm trying to convey to the people that I speak to.
Dillard hopes to persuade his fellow union members to accept a contract that's nearly identical to one they rejected just over a month ago. The state's biggest public sector union signed on for a 3-year wage freeze and other concessions over the summer, but members of the Public Employees Federation, which represents about 56,000 engineers, doctors, and other professionals, did not. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo agreed to suspend the layoffs while union members vote again.
As I said from the beginning, we needed to achieve the financial savings that we needed, the revenue savings. But on a human level, the hardship of 3,500 layoffs was something we were going to do everything possible to avoid. So it's now up to them. And when I say it's up to them, it's up to them.
Cuomo declined to make any major changes to the contract. Still, union officials have fanned out across the state, holding meetings and trying to convince the rank and file to hold their noses and vote yes. Here's President Ken Brynan in a video message on the union's website.
And yes, the new agreement saves the jobs of 3,496 of our coworkers. And that's why I'm encouraging our members to vote yes.
But if you judge instead by the spirited debate and the comments on the union's Facebook page, there's a real chance the second vote will end like the first one.
We're not voting on layoffs. We're voting on a contract. And the contract is a terrible concession contract.
Andrew Coates is a psychiatrist at the State Mental Hospital in Albany. He's part of a group that's urging union members to vote no on the deal, in part because it offers little protection from future layoffs.
It's layoffs now or layoffs later. And the question for our union is what puts us in the strongest position to stand up. That thinking is what has convinced me that to vote against this contract.
What everyone in the union seems to agree on is that Governor Cuomo should look elsewhere to balance New York's books, including extending the so-called millionaire's tax that's set to expire at the end of the year. But E.J. McMahon at the Manhattan Institute, which advocates for less government spending, says Cuomo's position isn't as harsh as the unions are making it out to be.
Compared to some other states, he is charting a moderate course. If you look in other states, for instance, California and several other states, there were some fairly significant actions taken to reduce payroll costs, including mass layoffs and payless furloughs. That was not the case in New York State.
Voting on the Public Employees Federation contract ends tomorrow morning. If the union votes to reject the deal a second time, up to 3,500 layoffs could be announced immediately, unless Governor Cuomo decides to grant another reprieve. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.